The Power of Now, Urquhart Tolle. Belinda Peters. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans, that the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come its way. Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it. Begin it now. Do you resent doing what you're doing? It may be your job, or you may have agreed to do something and are doing it, but part of you resents and resists it. Are you carrying unspoken resentment towards a person close to you? Do you realise that the energy you thus emanate is so harmful in its effects that you are in fact contaminating yourself as well as those around you? Have a good look inside. Is there even the slightest trace of resentment, unwillingness? If there is, observe it on both the mental and the emotional levels. What thoughts is your mind creating around this situation? Then look at the emotion, which is the body's reaction to those thoughts. Feel the emotion. Does it feel pleasant or unpleasant? Is it an energy that you would actually choose to have inside you? Do you have a choice? Maybe you are being taken advantage of. Maybe the activity you are engaged in is tedious. Maybe someone close to you is dishonest, irritating, or unconscious. But all this is irrelevant. Whether your thoughts and emotions about the situation are justified or not makes no difference. The fact is that you are resisting what is. You are making the present moment into an enemy. You are creating unhappiness, conflict between the inner and the outer. Your unhappiness is polluting not only your own inner being and those around you, but also the collective human psyche of which you are an inseparable part. The pollution of the planet is only an outward reflection of an inner psychic pollution. Millions of unconscious individuals not taking responsibility for their inner space. Either stop doing what you are doing, speak to the person concerned, and express fully what you feel, or drop the negativity that your mind has created around the situation and that serves no purpose whatsoever except to strengthen a false sense of self. Recognizing its futility is important. Negativity is never the optimum way of dealing with any situation. In fact, in most cases, it keeps you stuck in it, blocking real change. Anything that is done with negative energy will become contaminated by it, and in time give rise to more pain, more unhappiness. Furthermore, any negative inner state is contagious. Unhappiness spreads more easily than a physical disease. Through the law of resonance, it triggers and feeds latent negativity in others, unless they are immune, that is, highly conscious. Are you polluting the world or cleaning up the mess? You are responsible for your inner space, nobody else's, just as you are responsible for the planet. As within, so without. If humans clear inner pollution, then they will also cease to create outer pollution. Look at me, Anita Bruckner, Belinda Peters. Once a thing is known, it can never be unknown. It can only be forgotten. And in a way, that bends time. So long as it is remembered, it will indicate the future. It is wiser in every circumstance to forget, to cultivate the art of forgetting. To remember is to face the enemy. The truth lies in remembering. My name is Frances Hinton, and I do not like to be called Fanny. I work in the reference library of a medical research institute dedicated to the study of problems of human behaviour. I'm in charge of pictorial material, an archive said to be unparalleled anywhere else in the world, of photographs of works of art and popular prints depicting doctors and patients through the ages. It is an encyclopedia of illness and death, for in early days few maladies were curable, and they seem therefore to have exerted a dreadful fascination over the minds of men. We are particularly interested in dreams and madness, and our collection is rather naturally weighted towards the incalculable or the undiagnosed. Problems of human behaviour still continue to baffle us, but at least in the library we have them properly filed. I work with Olivia. She's my friend. You get a lot of borderline cases in libraries. Dr. Simek is an extremely reticent Czech or Pole. We are not quite sure which, and we do not see that it is our business to inquire. Dr. Simek often looks up, inclines his head politely and says, "Madam, if you would be so kind." I think that was the first phrase he learned when he came to this country. Dr. Simek lived in a large, dull house, up a few worn steps, somewhere near the world's end. The door was opened onto steamy light and a smell of cooking by a woman in an apron, whose face I could not see. I told her my name and why I had come. "Ah, yes," she said, in a rather surprisingly cultured foreign accent. "He worries about his work. I will take you up." She motioned toward a staircase carpeted with faded red. "If you would be so kind." That was obviously the origin of the phrase. I asked her to go ahead of me, which she did. She knocked on the door of a room on the second floor. "Dr. Simek," she murmured, and then in a louder tone, "Dr. Simek, a lady to see you." The door opened and a hoarse voice said, "Thank you, Mrs. Lazovska. Most kind." The landlady, or whatever she was, smiled at me and nodded her head. I found myself nodding back, and then I went in. It became clear to me at a glance that Dr. Simek was quite ill. He was seated by an ancient gas fire with a saucer of dusty water in front of it, and he was wearing an old silk dressing gown with a silk scarf tucked into the neck. The room was lit by a bright centre light and contained a narrow divan bed, a chest of drawers with china handles, such as might have come out of a housemaid's attic, a bookcase with a brick under one side where the leg had come off, and a little table on which stood a radio turned to some foreign station. On the back of the door hung one of those awful plastic wardrobes containing Dr. Simek's overcoat and his suit. He himself was seated in a chair covered in rubbed and faded velvet. He made as if to get up, but I went over to him and put my hand on his shoulder, and he brought the other hand and patted mine and smiled. I had thought I should find him in low spirits, but he seemed to have recovered a certain worldliness, a certain sophistication. When I handed over his files of notes, he inclined his head and murmured, "Most kind," and nodded to me to put them on the table. I asked him how he was, and he made a little face and said, "As you see, Miss Frances, as you see." And then, perhaps because he felt that he had been asking for sympathy, he fitted a yellow cigarette into his old-fashioned cigarette holder and asked me to sit down. I sat on the bed, because there was nowhere else to sit, and there was another knock on the door and it opened to reveal Mrs. Lasovska with two tall glasses of lemon tea on a tray.
"Your tea, doctor," she said, "and for your guest."
She put a small plate of strange biscuits on the table and urged,
"Eat, please, please."
Dr. Simek inclined his head to her as if dismissing her, and she took this as her cue to go. It was very quiet, except for the roar of the gas fire, and very hot. The tea was scalding, but I drank it as quickly as I could. I was anxious to get out of there, and yet constrained by some old politeness, as if I were a child again, on my honour to behave well. Dr. Simek took a lump of sugar in slightly trembling fingers, inserted it between his strong old teeth, and took a draught of tea. The gesture, which was repeated several times, made him seem incredibly foreign and reminded me, perhaps in the way his lip lifted, that he had been a vigorous man and, from the way his landlady treated him, an important one. Searching for something to say, I looked round the room and my eye fell on a photograph of a very beautiful woman on his chest of drawers. "Is that your wife?" I asked, aware that this was a crude question.
"My daughter," he replied. "Denka."
"She is very beautiful," I said.
"Yes," he said. "She was beautiful."
And the fingers trembled a little more, and the glass of tea was raised and emptied and lowered again. Then another yellow cigarette was inserted into the holder, and it was quite clear that Dr. Simek was ready for me to leave. Ballet Shoes, Noel Stretfield. Belinda Peters. It was Christmas when the term ended. The children at once settled down to making paper rings, which, when they were finished, Mr. Simpson hung all over the house. On Christmas Eve, Mrs. Simpson and Sylvia put holly over the pictures and mistletoe onto the lamp in the hall. The two doctors had secrets going on in their rooms that they would not tell anyone, and nobody could go in. Cook and Clara were busy in the kitchen all day long and told the children they were not to come down. Only Theo was not there. She was away in Manchester, putting final touches to the dances of a group of children from the academy who were appearing in the pantomime. Pauline and Petrova were with Sylvia while Posy was going to bed.
"There is a lovely feeling about Christmas Eve," Pauline said. "My inside almost hurts being excited. I can't sit still for wishing it was tomorrow."
Sylvia smiled. "You deserve a nice Christmas, darlings. You have been such hard-working children all the term. I want you to have lovely holidays."
"It's a lovely holiday, just not having to go to the academy," Petrova pointed out.
Sylvia looked worried. "Do you hate it so?" Petrova was just going to say how much she loathed it when Pauline kicked her, and she remembered how Theo had told them that they would be able to help by earning money. She flushed.
"No, I don't. It's quite fun, really."
She spoke as much as if she meant it as she could. Sylvia gave a thankful sigh. "Oh, I'm so glad. I wouldn't let any of you do it unless you were happy." Nana came to the door. "Do you know it's nearly 7, Petrova, and your bath's getting cold, and a big stocking of mine is waiting for you to hang it up."
"Stockings!" Pauline jumped up. "I shall come to bed now too, Nana, to make it quicker to get to Christmas morning."